an assassin. I'm a soldier.
You're neat. You're an errand boy. Sent by grocery clerks. To collect a bill.
White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance radio calling. This is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker on Saturn's Day. Yeah, October the 4th, 2014, Saturn's Day. Boy, it got cold last night around here. It was down in the high 40s, and we're not used to that. We've had a very warm summer, and I had to take all the air conditioners out of the windows and put them away and close up those windows and plug the cracks, man, because it got cold. Well, from the weather map, it looks like we're going to get some more of this stuff coming in, so I guess we better batten down the hatches. I think we're going to have a short fall and then probably a deep winter. And we had a lot of wind around here too. Yeah, things were blowing all over the place. One of our guys down in Florida just sent me about 4 big Cuban cigars today. And I used to smoke cigars, but I haven't smoked for a long time. And I'm not encouraging other people to smoke either, because I lost my first wife from smoking. But on the other hand, if you would like one of these Cuban hand-rolled cigars that were made by Cubans, probably the last factory inside the United States that's doing that, I forget what the details were on it. You want to send me a little donation? I'll send you a big old Cuban cigar. That's right. Okay. I've got four of them. And those things came from a refugee from Chicago. Yeah, he finally got out of there in time. Got him a place down in Florida now. He's real happy. So we've got another lone wolf down Florida way. Well, being as it's Saturday, it's that time again for Sling Blade. Yeah, Sling Blades. We got a show all set up, and this is the second part of his show on... what was that show? Just a minute here. It's a three-parter. It's on killing, and this is part two. Take it away, Sling Blade.
Here we're going to be covering part two of On Killing by Lieutenant Colonel David Grossman. I'm going to read some here real quick from Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals. Yes, he is a Jew also. The book is not what I thought it was so far. I'm only in the first chapter, but I thought he'd be a hardcore communist, and he seems to not denounce communism, but not really go for it. Or revolution shouldn't be pigeonholed by communism. And I thought he would have approved of the activities of the Weather Underground, but he doesn't, apparently. But under the heading of Ideology of Change, it says a prerequisite of an ideology is the possession of a basic truth. Well, we have a pretty good ideology then. We have a pretty strong ideology. And that is that we are witnessing the demise and intimate genocide of the white race. That is not hyperbole. It is a fact. And there's no way you can use some kind of verbal gymnastics to get around it. Now, one of the reasons why I don't completely trust this Jew, it says over here, is I detest and fear dogma. I know that all revolutions must have ideologies to spur them on. That in the heat of conflict, these ideologies tend to be smelted into rigid dogmas, claiming exclusive possession of the truth and the keys to paradise. Is tragic. Dogma is the enemy of human freedom. In a very small way, I agree with that. But it seems to me he doesn't want any ideology written down in stone. I believe that a future regime or government that is looking out for the interests of the white race, if that was ever to materialize, I believe they need to protect our biological and genetic heritage fanatically through a racially orientated constitution, which can be perceived as a dogma. So, it all depends on how you look at it. I just thought that was interesting. Okay, picking it up on killing, under the section on the nature of the victim. General James Garvin, the commander of the 82nd Airborne Division of World War II, carried an M1 Grand rifle, then the standard American infantry weapon of World War II. He advised young infantry officers not to carry any equipment that will make them stand out in the eyes of the enemy. Oftentimes, the criteria for deciding whom to kill are dictated by deciding who is manning the most dangerous weapon. In Steve Bankel's case, he selected the Viet Cong soldier who was sitting closest to the machine gun, and he would die because of it. Every surrendering soldier instinctively knows that the first thing he should do is drop his weapon. But if he is smart, he will also ditch his helmet. Holmes, who I said in the last show, I didn't remember what book he wrote, but the book is called War on the Mind. Holmes notes that the Brigadier Peter Young in the Second World War had no more regret about shooting a helmeted soldier or helmeted German than he would about banging a nail on the head. But somehow, he could never bring himself to hit a bareheaded man. It is because of this response to helmets that the United Nations Peacekeeping Force prefer to wear the traditional beret rather than a helmet, which might very well stop a bullet or save their lives in an artillery barrage. So someone will be less likely to shoot you if you're not wearing a helmet. Well, if you ever face black and brown, I wouldn't take that chance. I wouldn't count on them being hesitant of shooting you at all. Bruce, a Ranger team leader in Vietnam, had several personal kills, but the one that he could not bring himself to kill, even when he was directly ordered to do so, was when the target was a Viet Cong soldier who was also a woman. Many other narratives and books from Vietnam cover in great detail the shock and horror associated with killing female Viet Cong soldiers. And although fighting and killing women in combat is new to Americans and relatively uncommon throughout military history, it is not completely unprecedented. During the French Dahomey expedition, Dahomey, I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong, in 1892, hardened French foreign legionnaires faced a bizarre army of female warriors. And Holmes notes that many of these tough veterans experienced a few seconds hesitation about shooting or bayoneting a half-naked Amazon, and their delay had fatal results. Yeah, a few of their comrades died because they hesitated killing a woman. Listen, white man, you're not going to be, there's no guarantee you're going to be only shooting hard legs if the dollar collapses and society collapses. If you got to take out a woman to save your ass, you got to do it. You got to take out some yellow or black or brown screaming banshee wanting to cut your nuts off. You better take her down with extreme prejudice. Self-preservation is the highest law. Okay. There are men like one U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel, a Vietnam veteran, who told me, "I learned early on in life that there are people who are out there, that there are people out there who will hurt you if given the chance. And I've devoted my life to being prepared to face them. These men are quite often armed and always vigilant." Okay, now, this is the author talking about the guy who said that. These men who are quite often armed and vigilant are the guy, he's talking about the guy who said, "I learned early on in life that there are people out there who would love just, if they were given a chance, they would love the chance to hurt you and take what you got and everything else." So this is the author talking about people like that. And they would not misuse or misdirect their aggression any more than a sheepdog would turn on its flocks. But in their hearts, many of them yearn for a righteous battle, a wolf upon whom to legitimately and lawfully turn their skills. I don't know about that. I think just being prepared as best as you know how. There's no guarantees, but you might as well stack the odds in your favor. You do that by training. Physical distance between the killer and the victim. Emotional distance between the killer and the victim, including social distance, which considers the impact of a lifetime of viewing a particular class as less than human in a socially stratified environment. Cultural distance, which includes racial and ethnic differences that permit a killer to dehumanize the victim. Moral distance, which takes into consideration intense belief in moral superiority and vengeful actions. Well, we definitely have moral superiority over the other races. Most definitely. And I don't want to sound like a white supremacist saying that. I'm just, all you got to do is look. The prisons are not filled with black men because of racism. They're filled because of shit that they have done. Mechanical distance. This includes the sterile video game unreality of killing through a TV screen, a thermal sight, a sniper sight, or some other mechanical buffer. Very easy to kill through those. Each man a firing squad. Okay, blindfolding the victim provides psychological distance, and the knowledge of the victim's guilt provides relevance and rationalization. Now, I don't know, I may not have highlighted that, but it said in this book that when a man is blindfolded, a man that is about to be executed, when he's blindfolded, he's not blindfolded for the sake of the man being executed. The man being shot, being executed, is blindfolded for the sake of the guys pulling the trigger. Because if he's not blindfolded, you tend to look in their eyes, you take pity on them, and you could purposely miss. When you cover the eyes, it's easier to kill. The enemy who fights to a noble death validates and affirms the killer's belief in his own nobility and the glory of his cause. Thus, a World War I British officer can speak admirably to homes of German machine gunners who remained faithful until death. They fought until they were killed, he said. They gave us hell. And T.E. Lawrence, other known as Lawrence of Arabia, immortalized in prose the German units who stood firm against his Arab forces during the rout of the Turkish army in World War I. This T.E. Lawrence writing this, you know, Lawrence of Arabia. He says, I grew proud of the enemy who had killed my brothers. They were 2,000 miles from home, without hope and without guides, in conditions bad enough to break the bravest nerves. Yet, their sections held together, shearing through the rack of Turk and Arab like armored ships, high-faced and silent. When attacked, they halted, took position, and fired to order. There was no haste, no crying, no hesitation. They were glorious. You would only find a white man to write words like that about his white enemy. Hell, in the Pacific Islanders, especially like the Maori people of New Zealand and other places, I believe it was Maori in Australia too, they don't allow their enemy. I mean, you know, if their enemy surrenders to them, they eat them. They think the best insult you can serve your enemy is to make feces out of them. You know, eat them and then they become feces. I've heard about that in documentaries. I've heard Maori people even say that. All right. These are noble kills which place the minimum possible burden on the conscience of the killer, and thus the soldier is able to further rationalize his kill by honoring his fallen foes, thereby gaining stature and peace by virtue of the nobility of those he has slain. That's going to help you, you know, not feel guilty, then it would be a good thing to talk good about the ones you kill. the story here. So one of the things that made Vietnam particularly traumatic was that due to the nature of guerrilla warfare, soldiers were often placed in situations in which the line between combatant and non-combatant was blurred. There's a quote here from Edward Doyle, who wrote a book called Three Battles. For the tense battle, prime GIs ordered to seal off the village. The often subtle nuances and indicators used by interrogators to identify VC from civilian, combatant from non-combatant, were a luxury they felt they could not afford. The decision, VC or not VC, often had to be reached within a split second and was compounded by the language barrier. The consequences of any ambiguity sometimes proved fatal to Vietnamese villages or villagers. In Ben Sop, which is a town, I guess, one unit of American soldiers crouching near a road leading out of the village were on the lookout for VC. Vietnamese man approached their position on a bicycle. He wore black pajamas, the peasant outfit adopted by the VC. As he rode 20 yards past the point where he first came into view, a machine gun crackled some 30 yards in front of him. The man stumbled dead into the muddy ditch. One soldier grimly commented, "That's a VC for you. He's a VC, all right. That's what they wear." He was leaving town. He had to have some reason to be leaving. Major Charles Malloy added, "What you're going to do when you spot a guy? What are you going to do when you spot a guy in black pajamas? Wait for him to get out his automatic weapon and start shooting? I'm telling you, I'm not going to do that." The soldiers never found out whether the Vietnamese was VC or not. Such was the perplexity of a war in which the enemy was not a foreign force, but lived and fought among the people. As we read the words of these men, we can place ourselves in their shoes and understand what they are saying. They were men trained to kill in a tense situation, and they had no real need to justify their actions. So why did they try so hard? "That's a VC for you. He's a VC, all right. That's what they wear. He was leaving town. He had to have some reason to be leaving." It may be that what we are hearing here is someone trying to desperately justify his actions to himself. He has been placed in a situation in which he has been forced to take these kinds of actions, maybe even make these kinds of mistakes. And he needs desperately to have someone tell him that what he did was right and necessary. Which our Vietnam veterans didn't get. Okay? All right. Sometimes it is even more difficult. For example, consider the situation that this U.S. Army helicopter pilot found himself in Vietnam. Off to our left, we could see a couple of downed Hueys, which are helicopters, UH-1H. Helicopters inside of the rice paddy. Strangely, just as I reached the corner of the hub, I noticed an old lady standing almost dead center of the hub, meaning this, in the middle of this rice paddy, in this clearing between all tree lines. Center of the hub, casually planting. All right, no, this old lady standing almost dead center of the hub, casually planting rice, still zigzagging. I looked back over my shoulder at her, trying to figure out what she was doing there. Was she crazy or just determined not to let the war interfere with her daily schedule? Glancing again at the burning Hueys, it dawned on me what she was doing there, and I turned back. "Shoot that old woman, Hall," I yelled. But Hall, the door gunner, who had been busy on his own side of the chopper, had not seen her before and looked at me as if I'd gone crazy. So he passed her without firing, and I zigzagged around the paddies, dodging sniper fire while I filled Hall in. She has a 360 degree view over the trees around the villages. I yelled, "The machine gunners are watching her, and when she sees the Hueys coming, she faces them, and they concentrate their fire over the spot. That's why there's so many down Hueys down there. She's a goddamn weather vane for them. Shoot her." Paul gave me a thumbs up, and I turned to make another pass, but Jerry and Paul in another helicopter had caught on to her also and put her down. For some reason, as I again passed our burning Hueys, I could not feel anything but relief at the old woman's death. That's written by D. Bray. D stands for Daniel, David, whatever. Prowling for POWs. Yeah. Okay. Then we're going to talk about dark areas, slaying the ignoble enemy. All right. Actually, no, I'm going to jump ahead. I want to check something out here. Was the woman being forced to do what she was doing? Was she truly a Viet Cong sympathizer or a victim? Were Viet Cong weapons being held on her family and on her? And would anyone have done any differently than these pilots under the circumstances? Possibly. But possibly they would not have lived to tell about it if they had done differently. Certainly no one will ever prosecute these men. And most certainly they will have to live with these kinds of doubts for the rest of their lives. Sometimes the trauma associated with these gray area killings in modern combat can be tremendous. Look, I don't like to kill people, but I've killed Arabs, noted the unconscious dehumanizing of the enemy. Maybe I'll tell you a story. A car came towards us in the middle of the Lebanese war without a white flag. 5 minutes before, another car had come, and there were four Palestinians with RPGs, rocket-propelled grenades, in it. Killed three of my friends. So this new type of car, I don't know how to pronounce this, P-E-U-G-E-O-T, Pergo or whatever, Pugo, must be some kind of French car. This car came towards us, and we shoot. And there's a family there, three children, and I cried, but I can't take the chance. It's a real problem. Children, father, mother, all the family was killed. But we couldn't take the chance. And that's by Gabi Bashan, Israeli reservist in Lebanon, 1982. Close-range murder of prisoners and civilians during war is a demonstrably counterproductive action. Executing enemy prisoners stiffens the will of the enemy and makes him less likely to surrender. Yet in the heat of battle, it happens quite often. Several of the Vietnam veteran soldiers I interviewed said, without detailed explanation, that they never took prisoners. Often in school and training situations, when it is impractical to take prisoners during operations behind enemy lines, there is an unspoken agreement that the prisoners have to be taken care of. But in the heat of battle, it is not really all that simple. In order to fight at close range, one must deny the humanity of one's enemy. Surrender requires the opposite, that one recognizes and takes pity upon the humanity of the enemy. A surrender in the heat of battle requires a complete and very difficult emotional turnaround by both parties. The enemy who opts to posture or fight and then dies in battle becomes a noble enemy. But if at the last minute he tries to surrender, he runs a great risk of being killed immediately. Holmes writes at length on this process. Surrendering during battle is difficult. Charles Carrington suggested no soldier can claim the right to quarter if he fights to the extremity. T. TP Mark saw seven German machine gunners shot. They were defenseless, but they had chosen to make themselves so. We did not ask them to abandon their guns. They only did so when they saw that those who were not mowed down were getting closer to them, and the boot was now on the other foot. Ernst Junger agreed that the defender had no moral right to surrender in these circumstances. The defending force, after driving their bullets into the attacking one at five paces distance, must take the consequences. A man cannot change his feelings again during the last rush with a veil of blood before his eyes. He does not want to take prisoners, but to kill. During the cavalry action at Moncel in 1914, Sergeant James Taylor of the 9th Lancers saw how difficult it was to restrain excited men. Then there was a bit of a melee, horses neighing and a lot of yelling and shouting. I remember seeing Corporal Bolt run a lance through a dismounted German who had his hands up and thinking that, and I was thinking that was a rather bad thing to do. Harold Durden, a medical officer on the Western Front, read a letter written by a young soldier to his mother. When we jumped into their trench, mother, they all had their hands up and shouted, "Comrade, comrade." And that means "I give" in their language. But they had to have it, mother. Sincerely yours, your loving Albert. No soldier who fights until his enemy is at close arm's range in any war has more than perhaps a 50-50 chance of being granted quarter. If he stands up to surrender, he risks being shot with the time-honored comment, "Too late, chum." If he lies low, he will fall victim to the grenades of the mopping-up party in no mood to take chances. Tell you what, fratricide. In 1900, our race was over 30% of the world's population. Well, these Jews did a number on us, didn't they? Okay, Hannah Arendt noted this failure to resist the Nazis in her study of the banality of evil. Whatever. Jeff Cooper, writing from experience in criminology, Jeff Cooper is a shooting guy, he's a gun guy. He wrote a book about gun defense. You can get it from Paladin Press. And he says, when you're in a situation, man, you shoot to kill. You don't take no quarter. If someone busts into your house, they have to die. That was his take, man. It was a very interesting book, very thin book, too. Like Metzger says, some of the best books are thin. All right, comments on this tendency in civilian life. Any study of the atrocity list of recent years, Starkweather, Richard Speck, Charles Manson, Richard Hickok, and Kerry Smith, etc., shows immediately that the victims, by their appalling ineptitude and timidity, virtually assisted in their own murders. Any man who is a man may not, in honor, submit to threats of violence, but many men who are not cowards are simply unprepared for the fact of human savagery. They have not thought about it. Incredibly, as this may appear to anyone who reads the papers or listens to the news, and they just don't know what to do when they look right into the face of depravity or violence. They are astonished and confounded. Now, what I described is a perfect example of what's happening in our race. In Wichita, Kansas, in 2000, I believe December 14th, Reginald Carr and Jonathan Carr, two black thugs with lengthy arrest records and criminal records, both in their early 20s. They only had one gun on them. They had a 380 pistol. But they broke into this house where a bunch of clean living white kids lived. You know, Christian kids, went to a Christian school. A couple of them wanted to be teachers and missionaries and stuff like that. I think there was two guys there and three women, or two women and three guys. I don't remember. They broke into the house and they took turns raping the women. Now, one of the guys was like, you know, kind of a big guy, you know, basketball player, he coached football and stuff like that. It's funny how I remember the black thugs, but I don't remember the white victims. Huh. That bothers me. I can't remember one name of the white victims. That's messed up. But anyways, they took turn raping the women. And when they had their fun raping the women, they forced the guys to do sexual acts with the girls and forced them to do sexual acts. They forced the guys to do sexual acts with each other and the ladies with each other. Well, then they piled into two cars. There's only one gun. The two black pieces of shit only had one gun. But they piled in the two cars, went around the various ATMs, emptied out the accounts. Then they took them to a snow-covered football field, a high school football field, and shot them. Execution style. And there all five, there were four or five of them, I think there was five of them, were made to kneel in the snow naked. And I don't know who the trigger guy was. And they're just laughing and thought it was just funny. The whole time, they just had a great time, these two black pieces of shit. And they would go, and the guy who shot them will go, come behind one at a time, shooting them in the back of the head. They didn't fight. They didn't put up any kind of struggle at all. Maybe they thought if they didn't put up any struggle at all, that the blacks would have mercy on them and leave them alone and let them go. What have we become? White men and women out there, don't ever allow yourself to be put in a situation like that. If someone rings your doorbell, and first of all, you should keep your doors locked, even if you're home. Someone comes to your door, you got to look out your peephole or a side window or something and see who it is. I remember one time I lived in this studio apartment, and there's someone knocking on my door. Now, if they're knocking on the interior door, that means they're standing between my screen door and the actual door. The door with the deadbolt. Something wasn't right about that. So I looked out to the window off to the side of the door. And sure enough, there was a black guy standing between my screen door and my interior door. And I knocked on the window. What do you want? So, oh man, I need gas in my car, man. My car's out, this and that. I'm like, what the fuck are you standing between my doors for? So, oh man, you know, and I just kind of went off on the guy. And finally, I told him to back up to the banister, you know, because it was, I don't know how to describe it. It was like a walkway. You know, if you was to walk out my front door, there's a banister where you can look down to the first floor. I was on the second floor. And then I went outside with a weapon. I'm like, what the fuck you think you're doing? You're going to stand between my screen? Wait, I think you were trying to bum rush me once I opened up the door. No, man, it wasn't about that, man. You said, who sent you up here? Of all the apartments to come, I mean, there's apartments all over here. Why come to my apartment? Well, the guy downstairs sent me up here. And I knew exactly who he was talking about. This piece of shit freaking Jew who lived downstairs. This Jew who I don't know what, he must have had some connections, but he got in trouble with the law messing around with an underage girl. This guy's like in his late 50s. I saw him on the sex offenders website one time. His picture was there for messing around with like a 14-year-old girl. And I tried to find his picture like 2 months later, and it was gone. But I went down and said, what the hell you think you're doing sending this guy up to my apartment? I don't know. He needed help. And this man said, bullshit. You did that on purpose. You know what I'm about. And you sent him, of all the apartments to send him to, you sent him to my apartment? Man, I went off on that Jew. You got to be careful. You just can't come to your front door and just open it up. You got to check and see who's out there. And if you're ever in a situation like this, it's better for you to be shot and go out fighting than to die on your knees. If you're ever abducted, the abductors do not want to make noise. They do not want you to make noise or cause a scene at point A, because they want to get you to point B, where they're free to kill you without attracting attention. This football field is, it's not like it was surrounded by houses. It was kind of like out in the middle of nowhere. Don't ever go down like that, white men and women. You fight. You die on your feet. Better that you die at point A with a gunshot wound than for you to be taken to point B, sexually humiliated, possibly tortured, and then killed. Can't stress it enough. This process that empowers criminals and outcasts in society can work even better when institutionalized as policy by revolutionary organizations, armies, and governments. North Vietnam and its Viet Cong proxies present one force that blatantly used atrocity as a policy and was triumphant because of it. In 1959, 250 South Vietnamese officials were assassinated by the Viet Cong. The Viet Cong found that assassination was easy, and it was cheap, and it worked. A year later, the toll of murder and horror went up to 1,400, and it continued for 12 more years. White man, they'll never go out peacefully. If you ever have to check out, you make a hell of a lot of noise. You put up one hell of a fight. All right. Where did I pick up at? The methodology and targets of these bombings made them very ineffectual compared with the strategic bombing conducted in World War II. Yet our own post-World War II study showed that in England and Germany... Oh, okay, I'll save myself some reading here. I mean, it talks about the bombings of London and Berlin and all that, where the people that faced the horrors of that bombing, they never suffered any... Very, very few of them suffered psychological effects of that. Okay, comparing to those who did actual killing in combat, suffered psychological effects. And you suffer psychological effects because you feel guilty for what you've done. Okay. But death up close and personal, visiting the manifest intensity of the enemy's wind of hate upon its victim, such death can be hideously effective at snapping the will of the enemy and ultimately achieving victory. I believe this is about something that happened in South America. The squad with a death order entered the house of a prominent community leader and shot him, his wife. Well, it could have happened in Vietnam, but it doesn't say. It's from Jim Graves' The Tangled Web. So... Yeah, maybe it's Vietnam. But a squad with a death order entered the house of a prominent community leader and shot him, his wife, his married son, and daughter-in-law, a male and female servant, and their baby. The family cat was strangled. The family dog was clubbed to death, and the goldfish scooped out of the fishbowl and tossed onto the floor. When the communists left, no life remained in the house. A family unit had been eliminated. You know, I mean, just... that's like a psychological thing to do. It makes the surrounding community fear you. Killing everything in the house, even the goldfish. A case study in atrocity. This is a first-hand account of a psychological response of a Canadian soldier who was confronted with the vilest possible aspect of atrocity when serving in the UN peacekeeping force sent to the Congo in 1963. Try and get this whole story in because this is one amazing story. It's not pretty. It was written under the pseudonym of Alan Stewart Smith or Nom de Plume, whatever that means. Colonel Stewart Smith served 23 years as a UN peacekeeper, progressing in rank from private to full colonel, wounded twice and was awarded the UN medal and mentioned in various dispatches, Canadian decoration, and a distinguished service order. After retirement in 1986, he was offered and accepted a professorship at a major American university where he taught criminology for 2 years. Note the two-edged sword of atrocity here. Note the way in which it both enables and entraps the killers in this case. And then note the way that their atrocity enables the soldier who must kill someone caught in the act of atrocity. Listen to this story. Remember, it's in the Congo in 1963. As I approached the village, the sound of moaning punctuated with deep laughs was clearly audible. The rear of the church contained two small dirty windows at eye level through which I looked. Although the interior of the church was dark by comparison by the blazing outdoor sunlight, I could pick up the forms of two naked black men torturing a young white woman whom I assumed to be the nun or teacher. She was stripped naked and was stretched out in the aisle of the church, arms pulled tightly over her head by one of the rebels while the other knelt on her stomach and repeatedly touched her nipples with a burning cigarette. She had burn marks on her face and neck as well. Uniforms of the soldiers were thrown over the back of the pew, and female garments were scattered near the floor. A carbine lay in the aisle beside the young woman. Another rifle had been left leaning against the wall near the uniforms. There appeared to be no one else present in the church. On my signal, we burst into the cathedral, our weapons on full auto. "Stand still," I bellowed. "UN troops, you're under arrest." I didn't want to do it that way, but damn it, I was still a soldier and subject to the Queen's regulations and orders. The rebels bounded to their feet to face us, eyes staring wildly. I carried a Sterling 9mm submachine gun, which I leveled at the two naked men. We were no more than 15 feet apart. The one who had been holding the woman's arms was visibly shaking with fear, his eyes flinging uncontrollably about the room. In a second, they rested on the rifle laying in the aisle. The nun had rolled onto her stomach, clutching her breast, rocking from side to side, moaning in pain. "Don't be a fool, man," I cautioned. But he did it anyways. In a burst of panic, he emitted a loud, piercing wail and dove for the rifle. Landing on his knees, he grabbed the weapon and, turning his terrified face to mine, attempted to bring his weapon to bear. My first burst caught him in the face, the second full in the chest. He was dead before he fell over, a body missing most of its head. The second terrorist began to wave his arms frantically up and down like a featherless black bird attempting to take flight. His eyes caught flitting back and forth between the muzzle of the Sterling and his own weapon, which was leaning against the wall a good 10 feet away. "Don't do it! Don't do it!" I ordered, but he emitted a loud, "Yah!" and scrambled for the rifle. I warned him again, but he grabbed the weapon, worked the action to place a round in the chamber, and began swinging the muzzle toward me. "Kill him, goddammit! Kill him!" screamed Corporal Edgerton, who now entered the church behind us. "Kill him now!" The rebel terrorist was now fully facing me, desperately attempting to swing the long barrel of the bolt-action rifle across his body to align it with my chest, his eyes locked on mine, wild, frantic eyes surrounded by fields of white. They never left mine. Not even when the powerful submachine gun rounds tore into his stomach, walked up his chest, and cut the carotid artery in the left side of his neck. His body hit the floor with a thud, blown apart by the blast of the Sterling. And still the eyes remained riveted to mine. Then his body relaxed and the eyes dilated, blinded in death. Prior to Okanda, I had not killed a human being, that is. I did not know for sure if I had killed. When one is firing at moving shadowy figures in the confusion of battle, one cannot be certain of the results. At Bridge 19, or at Bridge 191, or no, at Bridge 19, I killed many men when I detonated the charges, blowing an enemy convoy to Kingdom Come, but somehow the incident was not psychologically close. They were a long way off, and the cover of night hid their shapes and movement, their very humanity. But here in Okanda, it was different. The two men I killed were practically within arm's reach. I could see their facial expressions clearly, even hearing their breathing, seeing their fear. I could smell their body odor. And the funny thing was, I didn't feel a damn thing. Stuart Smith's emphasis. There have been two nuns at Okanda. The young one we saved, but the older one we didn't. When we first entered the church, I was standing slightly behind the altar, off to one side. From that position, I couldn't see the front of the altar, a rather large affair made of, a cross towering over it. Perhaps it was a good thing I couldn't, for the rebels had used the altar to butcher the old nun. They had stripped her naked, but they had not assaulted her sexually, probably because she was elderly and obese. Instead, they set her upright with her back against the altar, nailed her hands onto the apparent mimicry of the crucifixion. Then they cut off her breasts. What is it about these niggers that cut off breasts? They did the same thing to Shannon Christian in Knoxville. And with the bayonet in the final act of savagery, drove the bayonet through the back of her mouth and into the altar, impaling her in an upright position. Evidenced by the struggle showed that she had not died instantly from the bayonet wound, but had probably succumbed to the loss of blood from the wounds on her chest. She had a white man's penis and testicles shoved partially in her vagina. Her severed breasts were not present. We found the owner of the male genitalia tied spread eagle in the middle of the village compound, with the nun's breasts attached to his chest with sharpened sticks. Before we departed Okanda, the young nun asked to meet the soldier who had saved her life. She was clothed now, and she had cleaned up a little bit with the help of our medic. I was surprised to see how young she was, early 20s or younger. She required a number of sutures in her vagina and would need burn treatments as well. I didn't admire her decision to remain in enemy territory when she was given ample opportunity to leave, but I did admire her spunk. When we met, I looked into her eye, or she looked me in the eye and said, "Thank God you came." She had been badly beaten, but not defeated. As for me, I turned 19 only 2 days previous, and had still suffered from the native upbringing of a good Christian family. I lost a lot of that upbringing in Okanda. There is no honor here, no virtue. The standards of behavior taught in homes and churches and schools of America have no place in battle. They were mythical concepts, good only for raising of children, but to be cast aside forever from this moment on. No, I didn't feel guilt, shame, or remorse at killing my fellow man, these niggers. I felt pride. I inject the word niggers there. Alan Stewart Smith, Congo Whore. He wrote a book called Congo Whore. Wow, check that out, man. That says a lot, that last paragraph there. Still suffered from a native upbringing of a good Christian family. And he lost that upbringing at O'Connor because he saw the world as it really is. He saw the racial realities. I don't know if this man ever developed to being a racist like me. I bet he harbors some of that. How can you witness that and not have racist feelings? But this isn't some obscure story. This goes on every day in America. Definitely every week. You bet your ass every week in America, blacks are raping white women from coast to coast like butter and toast. If they're not raping white women, they're killing white women, assaulting white women, abducting white women, raping white men, gangbanging white men, meaning, you know, multiple blacks ganging up on one white. This is an interesting story here. And it just goes to show that if you're going to hold on to, you know, we're yellow, black, red, and white, we're all precious in His sight, all that Christian mantra and that mindset, I don't know if that's going to save you when the time comes. You may hesitate, like those French Foreign Legion soldiers did against those Amazon female warriors. And if you hesitate in pulling the trigger, you could get yourself killed, or your comrades, or your family members. You can't even think about it, and you cannot feel guilty for what you've done. I've seen plenty of episodes of Lockup on MSNBC. And I've heard black inmates talk about why they're in prison for murder and this and that. A couple times they show the picture of the victim. I always saw a white woman or a white family that was victimized by this black. I didn't notice any guilt in his voice or in his eyes. I didn't see any remorse. Because he had none. No, we're the race that has to feel remorse and pity. And now we're being done in because of it. Oh, I'm not discounting the morality, how the white morality, the morality of the white race, has not declined also. But remember the death triangle. If you look in the mirror and you imagine and draw an imaginary line from your left temple to your right temple, to your right temple to the tip of your chin, from the tip of your chin to your left temple, it's pretty much a done deal. You shoot someone in the death triangle. Oh yeah, they could survive. If you shoot someone straight under the nose, like in the gums area above the front teeth or the top teeth, chances are it's going to sever the spine. And chances are you may shoot them through the medulla oblongata or something. Quick kill techniques. Also double tap into the back of the head. I mean, that's nothing wrong with that. All right, the killing stage, even without thinking. Two shots, bam, bam, just like that. That's how we were trained, in quick kill. When I killed, I did it just like that, just like how I've been trained, even without thinking. That was a Vietnam veteran named Bob talking about how he killed. Jack Thompson, a hidden enemy, said combat addiction is caused when during a firefight the body releases a large amount of adrenaline into your system and you get what is referred to as a combat high. this combat high is like getting an injection of morphine. You float around laughing, joking, having a great time, totally oblivious to the dangers around you. The experience is very intense, and if you live to tell about it. Problems arise when you begin to want another fix of combat and another, before you know it, you're hooked. As with heroin or cocaine addiction, combat addiction will surely get you killed. Like any addict, you get desperate and will do anything to get your next fix. Well, be that as it may, wouldn't mind hearing about white dudes getting combat highs, killing racial enemies. That sounds bad. Why should we be victimized like that? Why should we just stand there and allow ourselves to be persecuted or assaulted or brutalized? I don't know if I'm going to be able to finish any more of this. I mean, we definitely got enough for one more show, maybe two. Maybe I'll get it all in on the next show. But there will be an On Killing Part 3. I hope you hear these shows in order. And contemplate, think about it. You should be contemplating and meditating on killing. Allow yourself to be thinking about scenarios where you're attacked, or there's a black or a brown that does a home invasion and you're at home with your wife and kids, or you're at a parking lot and you're assaulted. Meditate on this. Sharpen your mind like you sharpen your knife. In your conjured up scenario, you kill mercilessly, ruthlessly. And you know what? Because of the political climate we live in, you don't want to stay around and fill out a police report. I wouldn't do it. So we're going to starve the sheep inside of us and feed the wolf. Become wolves in human shape. Shield Wall says, I will not have pity on an enemy that will most likely show me no mercy or compassion. And Wolfheart says, I will be ruthless. So we want to secure the existence of our people and the future for white children. Carpe Noctem.